right, folks, welcome to another edition of John Solomon Reports. This is Daniel Payne. I'm a reporter with Just the News. As you might have already guessed, John Solomon is not here today. He's taking a little vacation, and he's left me in charge. And we'll know by the end of the week whether or not that was a wise decision on his part. But in the meantime, I'm glad to be here, and I hope you all enjoy a little change-up of hosts for a few days. There's obviously a lot of news to cover these days, but of course, seemingly overshadowing everything is the COVID-19 pandemic, which has been ongoing in the U.S. for nearly a year at this point. We're almost at a year since the first confirmed case in the United States. That's pretty much been in the headlines since January. COVID cases, COVID deaths, the spread of the virus, the lockdowns, the school closures. We're all, unfortunately, very familiar with it at this point. Later this week, we're actually going to be focusing on a specific topic related to COVID-19, and that's the pandemic's effect on children, specifically the effects that lockdowns are having on kids. But today, I thought we'd do just a brief, broad overview of the pandemic here in the U.S. Of course, it is a global phenomenon, but certainly we are focused on it most, particularly here in the U.S. I want to look at a few pandemic stories you may have missed because they're not generally covered very heavily in the media. And as I said, this has been pretty much the dominant media story contending with certainly the presidential election of the past year. But there are a number of, I think, really important stories that the media does miss. They don't cover as thoroughly as they should. And of course, we try and bring you the best coverage we can of everything at Just the News, and we have covered a lot of these issues. And I want to add that we're going to have a guest on later. His name is Daniel Halpern. He's a professor at UNC Chapel Hill, and he was previously at Harvard. And he'll have some expert insight into the pandemic that I think you'll all find very valuable. It's a very good interview, so I want you to stick around for that. But before that, I'd like to focus on two major stories out of the pandemic right now, and I think some angles of them that you might not be aware of. The first is the pandemic in Europe. Now, if you've been following this, you know that cases in Europe skyrocketed over the past several weeks or months. Cases confirmed positive tests were pretty low over the summer in most cases. For most countries in Europe, Western Europe, they were pretty low. And there were a lot of folks in the U.S. who were pointing to the success that Europe had in mitigating the virus. They said the lockdowns and a lot of testing and social distancing policies and mask policies had really worked in suppressing the virus there. And it seemed to have worked for quite a while. There was really they seemed to be doing a lot better than significant parts of the rest of the world, including a number of U.S. states. But over the past few weeks or past month or two, the rate of positive cases there just exploded in a way that's kind of hard to comprehend. It's just the rate of cases there adjusted for population was very, very high. And that received a lot of media coverage at the time because, it was concerning. Why were cases surging again? Why was the virus coming back? It seemed like they'd beaten it back. What seems to have happened there is cases seem to have peaked. Now, of course, you want to take all that with a grain of salt and make those claims very cautiously because you never know what's going to happen the next day or next week. But certainly there has been sustained decline in daily new cases for a couple weeks now, maybe even longer than that, in France, Italy, Germany, the United Kingdom, Spain. These are all places where the virus appeared to be spiraling out of control. And the cases that they were confirming every day seem to have peaked a number of weeks ago. So that's something you may not have been too aware of because certainly the rise of cases there was pretty heavily covered, as was the new wave of lockdowns and restrictions that a lot of governments there imposed in the wake of those cases. But it seems like they're on the downward swing of things. It's not really clear what is the cause of that? Were the lockdowns the cause of that? Did people change their behavior? Did they close down restaurants? And, you know, it's that, of course, will be answered over the course of time. But it is certainly something to note that this what appeared to be a very troubling and concerning situation in much of Western Europe seems to be on the downward side of things. So that's very encouraging. You know, there's also very early and very tentative signs that that cases nationwide across the U.S. May be on a downward trend as well. Certainly a lot of the Midwestern states that were responsible for the recent surge appear to have hit their peak a while ago and are trending downward. Probably about the last 5 or 6 days, we've seen what appears to be a slight downward trend in cases nationwide around the U.S. And again, you have to be very cautious proceeding with that because it can just turn on a dime sometimes, and you never know if something else is going to spike or if more cases are going to go up. But those are two trends that are cautiously encouraging that that haven't got a whole lot of attention in the media that I think people at least should be made aware of. I think we should be aware every step of the way of what's going on in the pandemic and what's the course of the virus throughout the world. You know, another really critical, important part of this pandemic that's directly related to the number of cases that we've seen throughout the country and throughout the world is the way in which those cases are tested. Now, I want to say we actually have a pretty important report on this coming out at Just the News later this week. I believe it is tomorrow, so you want to keep an eye out for that. But right now, I can just want to draw folks' attention to the fact that the cases are an issue that I think tests are an issue that I think hasn't received the thorough kind of coverage that that it should have in the media up to this time. You know, many, if I believe it's a majority of cases in the U.S. and maybe the world, are tested by what's known as a polymerase chain reaction test. It's a PCR test. You've probably seen that in the news. These tests identify pathogens by taking a medical sample and subjecting it to amplification cycles. What happens is if a bit of virus is present, the PCR test will amplify it to the point that the device can identify it and categorize it as COVID or something else. It sounds pretty simple, but the crux of the issue is if a test has to go through a lot of amplification cycles to detect the virus, what that suggests is that the original viral sample was fairly small. A number of prominent virologists have pointed out that if a test goes through 35, 36, 38 amplification cycles before it finds a positive result, then what it's doing is taking a very, very small sample of virus and magnifying it to the point that it can declare it a positive sample. So what that means is that a lot of people who get positive test results may actually not be infectious or even actively infected, as it's kind of known in medical and epidemiological circles. The test may, in fact, just be picking up dead fragments of the disease or the virus at that point. Dr. Anthony Fauci, you're familiar with his work on COVID-19, I'm sure. He's been in the news for months and months. He was heavily involved with the White House at the outset of the pandemic. He said in July that in such cases, the tests are actually just picking up dead nucleotides rather than actual live virus. Now, in most cases, when a patient receives his positive test results, he doesn't receive the cycle threshold number either. That's something, if you, God forbid, get a positive COVID test, you might consider asking for the cycle threshold if your healthcare provider has it. If nothing else, it's another piece of personal medical information you can have. But overall, what we've seen, and we have a story coming about this at Just the News, like I said, is we've seen that this critical piece of information is missing from a lot of the COVID-19 debate, this metric by which a positive COVID test can be assessed. It really it doesn't feature prominently in state medical reports, in much of the medical discussion surrounding this. You're just not seeing that brought up a lot. It really does call into question what the rise and fall of cases really means. When we see them go up or down in Europe, in the U.S., in individual states, when we see these huge numbers denoting positive tests, what does that really signify? What do the peaks and valleys of COVID-19 really mean in relation to these tests and this number called the cycle threshold? This is something people should know. It is something people should at least be aware of. And, you know, at Just the News, we're working hard to bring you this and other critical data points of the pandemic so you can have the fullest picture of what's going on. So please stay tuned. I think we're going to have some good coverage on that. All right, folks. folks. We'll be back in just a bit to discuss the last year or so of the pandemic with UNC Professor Daniel Halperin, who I'm sure you're going to love to hear from.
Folks, Field of Greens is the healthiest thing I do every day, and I want you on this journey with me. Why? It's literally one scoop a day. It tastes great. I love the fruit flavors particularly, and it's completely improved my life and my health. This is nutrition the way nature intended. When I began taking a hard look at why I wasn't feeling good and why I felt unhealthy, why I was gaining weight, why I was losing energy, it wasn't just because I had hit my 50s. No, it was because I wasn't getting the right amount of fruit and vegetables in my diet. And listen, I'm just too busy to go to the store, clean up the vegetables, cook vegetable dinners, and make sure I hit the fruit. A Field of Greens stepped in. One scoop of powder in my drink or on my eggs in the morning, and boom, I was off and feeling better. And suddenly, I was losing weight. I was sleeping better. My metabolism went up. My blood sugar went down. My cholesterol went down, and my weight went down. And my doctor said, hey, whatever you're doing, keep it doing. You know what that is? It's Field of Greens. That's what I've been doing. Field of Greens is radically different. Each organic fruit and vegetable was medically chosen to support heart and vital organ health. I trust Field of Greens to keep me healthy. I promise you, you're going to love this product. But if for any reason you don't, they'll give you 100% money back guaranteed. Now, you're going to get 15% off your first order, plus free rush shipping because of the incredible partnership we have here at Just the News with Brick House Nutrition, and of course, Field of Greens. All you got to do to take advantage of this offer, visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code JustNews. That's promo code JustNews at fieldofgreens.com. Don't wait. Go to fieldofgreens.com today. Use the promo code JustNews for 15% off.
All right, folks, welcome back to John Solomon Reports. I'm your guest host this week, Daniel Payne. I'm a reporter with Just the News. And right now on the line, we have Daniel Halperin. He's a professor in the Department of Health Behavior, the Gilling School of Global Public Health at UNC. And one of his most recent publications is Facing COVID Without Panic, 12 Common Myths and 12 Lesser Known Facts About the Pandemic, Clearly Explained by an Epidemiologist. So we certainly can see he knows his stuff. Professor, it's good to have you here with us.
Likewise, thank you.
So earlier in the year, in a paper you wrote, you advanced a kind of cautious sort of herd immunity approach that might be preferable to the lockdowns and shutdowns that we saw at the start of the year and that we are continuing to see in some parts of the country and throughout the world. Do you still believe that there might be an alternative approach to dealing with the COVID pandemic, that something resembling herd immunity might be possible? And if so, what evidence have you seen to sort of bolster that belief over the past several months?
Right. Wow. Start off with an easy question, right? Yeah, that was in a paper that was published in a peer-reviewed public health journal in May, and I mentioned the issue in the book. I think in both instances, if I recall correctly, I referred to it as a possibly least terrible option. That was the wording I used, least terrible. So I don't think that it's a wonderful, perfect strategy by any means. But I think there's been a lot of polarization around COVID. 19 is, of course, there's a lot of polarization around a lot of things these days. Always wear a mask all the time. Don't bother wearing a mask. Herd immunity is a great way to deal with this. Herd immunity is absolutely ridiculous. We shouldn't even be talking about it. I try in many ways to steer a path where I think the evidence suggests it goes. And I think that it's easy to just dismiss something like herd immunity as being wacko or outside the realm of consideration. But look, as scientists, or I think maybe more, not only scientists, but certainly as a scientist, I think I need to look at any possible way out of this or any possible approach that could be useful. And I did not sign the recent so-called Great Barrington Proclamation. I was asked to sign it, and I largely agreed with it in many ways, but I couldn't sign on because I think there's still some problems. I think it was a little too blithe the way they said, you know, we just need to let everybody carry on and protect those that are vulnerable. I actually very much believe that and say that in my book, but it's a little easier said than done.
Right.
And so, you know, there's the criticism has been made, rightfully to some extent, that if we just did that in a pure kind of way, that still a lot of people would end up getting infected and vulnerable people would end up dying. And I take that point, but look, it's a very complicated issue, but the way I tend to see this now, which probably will sound a little outside the box, probably to some listeners, is that we are essentially dealing with, I think, when historians look back at this, they will say, and I don't know if they'll be looking back 100 years from now or even much, much sooner than that, but they'll look back at this and say, what this whole episode, let's call it, has been essentially about from a biological point of view, from a planetary point of view. What we're really talking about is that until the beginning of this year, there were four strains of coronavirus that have been circulating among humanity for many years. And fortunately, although they're very transmittable, and every year, literally billions of people get them because they're one of the main reasons that people get the common cold,
right,
they rarely kill people. And I say toward the end of the book, I propose the hypothesis, and I cite some evidence for this, that those other coronaviruses very likely made their appearance in a similar way as this one. In other words, in fact, there was a very interesting book review in the New York Times a few weeks ago by a biologist writing about COVID, and he presents compelling evidence that the so-called Russian flu of 1890, in other words, about 30 years prior to the Spanish flu, 130 years ago, the so-called Russian flu that killed maybe a million people, he presents evidence that it wasn't probably a flu at all, that it was probably one of the four common coronaviruses now.
Right.
And so that coronavirus, which today a lot of kids get as a kind of common cold and very rarely actually kills or hospitalizes anyone, and when it first made its entrance, it did so in a very deadly way. So this thing, which, you know, seems so horrible and is horrible, from a really long, long-term perspective, from if you sort of stepping away, big picture, long period of time perspective, it may be the case that in the future, and that could be as soon as a few years from now, or it could be longer than that, but at some point it's quite likely that this will end up being the fifth coronavirus, and it will be similar in the sense that every year many, many people will get it, mostly kids, but other people too, but that rarely people will die from. In other words, we're in the middle of this very ugly and difficult period where we're sort of learning to develop immunity to this new organism. But of course, that might be interesting from a scientific point of view. From a human point of view, that doesn't help if you're grandfather is in the hospital with this thing,
right,
you know, and potentially dying. So I don't want to minimize the fact that, you know, that, you know, when these things come, they're quite brutal, but they have a positive and negative side to them. And the negative side is pretty obvious, but
right,
the positive side is that they're kind of like a massive vaccination, right? So the Spanish flu, which we all have heard about 100 years ago, was horrific. And thankfully, COVID-19 is nowhere near as deadly as the
right,
Spanish flu was.
Right.
But it also, what it did was it sort of inoculated the human race, or huge parts of it, against that strain of the flu. So people have still died from that same strain in the 100 years since then, but vastly fewer people have died from it than did in those couple years that it ran amok.
Right.
So, you know, I understand I understand the thinking behind the immunity impulse, which is to say, look, we can't fight this. It's well, the reason I compare it to the four strains that cause the common cold is because even though the impact right now of coronavirus 19 is much, obviously, vastly more terrible than the other coronaviruses, but from a prevention point of view, trying to prevent the spread of this coronaviruses would be similar if we'd been trying to prevent the spread of the common cold. If we decided for some reason that we wanted to prevent everyone from getting the common cold this year. That's a tall order.
Right.
And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to prevent the spread of something which is spread very similar in many ways, and differently in other ways, but similar in many ways to the common cold. So I understand that impulse. Say, look, let's forget it. Look at this country I'm in now, Spain. They've had mask mandates, universal mask mandates for many, many months.
Right.
They've done, all kinds of things, and the cases have exploded, just as we're seeing in parts of the U.S. and so on. So the sense then is, why keep fighting? Just let it go. Let young people, it's true. I mean, the vast, vast majority of young, healthy people will be fine. In fact, the majority will probably be asymptomatic, won't even know they had it.
Right.
And let's do everything we can to try and protect those that are vulnerable. But that's the hard part. It sounds great, but how do you protect them? And I have some ideas, but it's not as easy as we would like it to be. That was probably a much longer answer than you wanted, by the way.
No, that was great. It was, I feel like I could listen to a lot more, because it certainly is just an incredibly pressing topic. How do we get out of this? What's the path out of this? And like you said, some people really believe that the sort of targeted or cautious herd immunity approach is the one. Of course, the looming vaccine that's set to be released into general circulation is another. Real quick, what do you think that the end point of this is going to be? And you kind of alluded to it, I think, that eventually this may sort of become almost like a epidemiological background noise, like the common cold, for want of a better term. But, do you think a vaccine is going to be the thing that that finally puts the lid on this? Or do you think that it's going to play just a small role? Or what do you think is ultimately the light at the end of the tunnel for just this entire miserable experience?
Right. Well, I can't predict. I mean, I think a lot of us are, of course, hopeful and optimistic that the vaccines, plural, will help immensely, and they probably will. It's going to be a little bit mushy and complicated, of course, like most things tend to be. It's not so clear cut, for example, who should get it.
Right.
I mean, I think there's a fairly good consensus on who should get it first, that obviously people at highest risk, as well as healthcare providers and so on, probably frontline workers should get it. But the question is, should eventually everybody get it? Should kids get it? Young people? Those are some, I think, some unanswered questions.
Right.
Because we don't know the long-term safety profile yet. We've rushed this whole process through, understandably, and I think, it was the right thing to do. But of course, when you rush something through, you don't have all the data. Right. And so it should help a lot. I mean, the whole point, many of the same people that say herd immunity is a terrible idea then say the vaccine is the solution. Well, I mean, in a way, that's what a vaccine is. It's a way of creating herd immunity through a vaccine. So, it should help, just like the annual flu. It may end up being similar to the annual flu vaccine in the sense that it helps a lot, but it's not perfect. And maybe it has to be recalibrated. And some years it'll do better than others, or maybe it'll be a lot better than that. I mean, certainly these first findings look very good, but I don't know. I'm waiting to see, like all of us.
Yeah, we certainly are, and we've been waiting for quite a while, and we're hoping that it's right around the corner. But I'm sure we'll know eventually, and I'm sure you'll have some input on how to assess and sort of figure out how to process everything that's happened over the last year and in the year to come. So, Professor Halpern, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate it. Thank you for all the work you're doing. I'm sure you are helping as much as anybody on this front, and hopefully we can have you back on again sometime soon when times look a little brighter.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care.
Folks, if you owe back taxes, fair warning, you're not going to like this. The IRS is mailing millions of pay up letters. Millions, I say. Then it's up to the 20,000 new IRS enforcement agents to find you. Why the IRS targets you and not millionaires? Well, because millionaires have tax lawyers. You don't. You'll pay up. Plus interest and penalties. You need Tax Network USA, and you need them now. Tax Network USA has brilliant war room strategies to solve your IRS problems quickly and in your favor. Like a preferred direct line to the IRS, they know which agents to deal with and who to avoid. It's not all bad news for you, because Tax Network USA learned of a special limited time IRS offer. They're willing to waive $1 billion in penalties if you qualify. So schedule your free confidential consultation to see if you qualify for this limited time IRS penalty canceling offer. To do so, call 1-800-245-6000. That's 1-800-245-6000, or visit tnusa.com/justnews. That's tnusa.com/justnews.
Okay, folks, that's it for today. I thank you for joining me on this special edition of John Solomon Reports. I'll be joining you again tomorrow and Thursday as guest host, and I'm looking forward to digging into more news with you for the rest of the week. Take care and be good.
At Just the News, we break the stories others in the media ignore or are too afraid to tell. We did it on Russia collusion, Hunter Biden, and the security and intelligence failures that preceded January 6th. Our stories have real impact and reach because we stick to the facts. I'm John Solomon. You can help me expand our honest, unvarnished, and unbiased reporting by becoming a premium member at Just the News. You'll get an ad-free experience and exclusive member-only access to events, and you'll be helping us dig up more truth. Join today at justthenews.com/subscribe.